I wonder if I could get a little help on a podium, because I actually do use notes. Anybody could possibly help me out with a podium? I see it coming. Well, it's fun to be here, particularly fun because Bert and then Phil both gave my talk in their own sequential way, so I feel like I have very little left to say. In fact, Phil this morning was daring in that he used a 16-minute clip, which I think bought you some time, was the way I understood why you were using it. And I want to top him, so before we're done, I do truly have a 17-minute clip before you're done on my stuff, so, because I'm not going to let the likes of Mr. Phil Stroud do better than me on this one. Oh, we got air up here. My notes are not going to work at all. So if you see me like this the whole time, you'll know why that's happened. If someone wants to bring me like a book, I could probably put them on the notes. Let me pray for us on that note. Father God, thanks so much for all you've been doing at this conference so far in just a few days. Thanks for what Chris shared, which also seems so helpful and needed for us. And I pray, God, that tonight you'd give us something new, despite the fact that Phil and Bert gave my talk previously. I do pray that there would be a new perspective and something helpful for us as a community of churches here on the East as we try to move forward into being as helpful and relevant to East Coast living as we possibly can be. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, I've called my little presentation tonight Discover Unexpected Friends. And I'll be talking a bit about making friends with people you wouldn't expect to, which we've all done in churches. Even the whole When a Vineyard Comes to Town perspective has been that people have found something surprising with them as they have... Yeah, I think that's probably fine. Thank you. When Vineyards Come to Town, you've made surprising friends. I've made a few surprising friends. Cambridge is sort of a unique place. Let me tell you about a few of the surprising friends I've made over my years there. One young woman first visited our church, and she would say it exactly this way if she were here, as a spy for a New Age movement. She was actually the right-hand woman of probably, if not the leading, right up there with the leading New Age teacher in the country. She was a biggie. She traveled all around the world with her, and she was living in Cambridge and heard about the growth of our church, and so she and her buddy snuck in under cover of darkness at one point to see what we were doing, to see how we were growing congregations, because they were interested in planting a New Age congregation. But this young woman decided, hang on, I kind of like what's happening here. So she stayed. Her friend left angrily. She stayed and ended up staying with us the whole time, gave her life to Jesus, is now publishing books and things like that about Jesus and about kind of New Age stuff, left this New Age guru behind. Meanwhile, we had been meeting in this school, and just recently we got like a cathedral, which I know most vineyards have cathedrals. We do have a Catholic cathedral we're meeting in now. And so we bought the cathedral. We left the school gym we were meeting in. And immediately, this young woman's friend swooped in and started her New Age congregation in the gym we were meeting in because she thought it had a good aura because of our growth. So they're there to this day. That's one unexpected friend I've met. Perhaps you've met similar people. I think about another young man, African-American man. As he put this to me recently, he says, I came into your church, and I came up and I saw you, Dave, and I just said to myself, meet the man. Which I think to him meant tall, white, deep voice, and I had the stage. And he said, I was already thinking I couldn't handle this. It's just so what he'd been fighting against. But a few things happened in our service which were encouraging to him. So on the one hand, we had a few people of color on our worship team. That was encouraging. Secondly, I'd asked our worship leader, who's quite gifted at this sort of stuff, to do a Stevie Wonder song, actually, as part of the sermon. And he heard that he thought, they're doing Stevie Wonder. And then during the worship set, our worship leader led a gospel song, just black gospel song as part of it. And the way my new friend put it, he said, and then our worship leader's name is Christopher, and then Christopher tried to lead a gospel song, and I emphasized the word tried, but I appreciated it. And I thought, wow, Christopher's pretty good. That's kind of harsh. So he stuck around. He had a bunch of stuff going on in his life, a bunch of crises happening because of vineyard-like stuff, Living Waters, among other things. He ended up just plunging into all this stuff, saw a lot of change in his life, and is now part of a church planting team in New York. Another friend, unexpected friend I met there, had grown up in one of the most liberal denominations, I think, possible in the country, in a very kind of liberal part of the country. It's kind of a center of kind of gay and lesbian rights agitation and things like that. He'd gone to Harvard Divinity School, notable evangelical seminary, just up the road from us, and had had some rough experiences in his denomination, was going through some kind of personal crises as well, heard about our church, snuck in just to see what was going on, to kind of take a breather, liked it. And as he put it, he said, I sat at the back the whole time because I was wondering if what you were saying was legit, because you were saying things that seemed to have power. I was waiting for you to say things that would alienate me because you'd be speaking kind of the evangelical party line. I never heard those things, but I heard a lot about the power of God. And so almost literally, I found myself moving forward in the rows as weeks went on. Ultimately, he'd had kind of a rocky relationship with this young woman. He ended up marrying her and is planning a church now, Vineyard Church. I've been invited into some unexpected conversations. Perhaps you've had these sorts of things. The National Office of the Unitarian Church is in Boston, and I got called in to the National Office of the Unitarian Church with a request to see if I would talk to them about church planting, because they said, you guys have done so well, we're trying to plant churches. John was talking about this earlier today. Some denominations, he said, are giving people $1 million to plant a church. They do not do that. They give people $250,000 to plant a church. $250,000. But they're planting almost none. And so they wanted to talk about how we'd done it and could I give them some tips so they could, you know, spark a Unitarian revival, which of course is in our interest to do. So what would interest me more than sparking a Unitarian revival? So I said, absolutely. So I brought a team of intercessors with me without telling them. They sat in the back row and just prayed. And we chatted about this and that. And they said, how much money did you get to come out and plant? And I said, well, actually, we had kind of a unique circumstance. I got no money because our money got taken by somebody else just for that. But nonetheless, I think on average they get about $2,000. I said, $2,000? We spent $250,000. And how do you do it? And I said, well, I'm assuming that you guys believe in a living God. And they said, oh. I said, you know, I actually think that living God thing's been a big part of what's worked for us. I don't know if it worked for you. But as a tip, and so they asked me questions. They were literally taking notes like, living God. And anything else you got for us? And I bought him a book by somebody I thought would appeal to Unitarians. It was a church growth book by Peter Wagner, Tom Rainier, and Elmer Towns. I don't know if you know those people, but they struck me as Unitarian-friendly sorts of people. So I gave them that. I could go on. I got so many interesting conversations. This last year, my favorite speaking engagement, I get invited on a fair amount of college campuses because we're around a million of them. And my favorite one ever was this year when I got invited to speak to the Campus Atheist Club at Tufts University. It went so well. A bunch of great stuff happened out of it, me talking to the Campus Atheist Club, that I'm now, looks like I'm going to be on the Atheist Club circuit. I got invited for campus to campus. I'm not sure if any of these stories have a particular point, so I'm just promising you, I'm not sure this is going anywhere, but perhaps the only place this is going is to at least suggest to you the thing I'd like to chat with you about tonight, which is, I think we have a unique opportunity as Vineyards here on the East Coast, which is exactly what Bert and Phil have been saying. Many denominations are asking what it will take to reach the East Coast urban centers in particular, because very few denominations to no denominations are. Boom churches almost exclusively are happening outside of the urban centers. There are some historic churches in the boroughs of New York, for instance, which are boom churches, but not many. And similarly, in my neck of the woods, there are a couple of churches that are booming, but not many. And so many, many people are asking, how do we reach where the people are in the urban centers? And there aren't many great answers to that. I've been in a few of those conversations. I've been in a few think tanks, both in the Vineyard and some outside of the Vineyard. And I can authoritatively tell you that I don't know. I've learned that by being in all these conversations. I don't know how to reach the East Coast urban centers. I think I can also authoritatively tell you, I don't think anybody else does either. Maybe I should just stop now. I'm sorry. I just sort of seem to shut down the whole conversation tonight. But even though I don't know, on the other hand, we have, as a church, had some fun experiences as a growing, multi-ethnic, believing church, God willing, in the shadow of Harvard, that I think have some relevance, at least in the conversation, to throw out, if not to really answer anything. I find myself thinking of one fairly minor story in the book of Acts that illustrates something that strikes me as fairly major. I actually had given you guys handouts, which, if you're like me, I wasn't always taking my little pamphlet with me. But if you took your pamphlet with you, there's a handout in it with some of the scriptures on it. And of course, it's so dark here, you won't be able to read it, but what the hey. Take a look with me at this passage in Acts that I think arguably is one of the central themes of the whole Bible, even though it's a fairly ancillary story to the whole narrative in Acts. It's long. It says this: God gave Paul the power to do unusual miracles, so that even when handkerchiefs or cloths that had touched his skin were placed on sick people, they were healed of their diseases, and any evil spirits within them came out. The story of what happened spread quickly all through Ephesus to Jews and Greeks alike. A solemn fear descended on the city, and the name of the Lord Jesus was greatly honored. Many who became believers confessed their sinful practices. A number of them who had been practicing magic brought their incantation books and burned them in a public bonfire. The value of the books was several million dollars, so the message about the Lord spread widely and had a powerful effect. But about that time, serious trouble developed in Ephesus concerning the way. It began with Demetrius, a silversmith who had a large business manufacturing silver shrines of the Greek goddess Artemis. He kept many craftsmen busy. He called the craftsmen together, along with others employed in related trades, and addressed them as follows: "Gentlemen, you know that our wealth comes from this business. As you have seen and heard, this man Paul has persuaded many people that handmade gods aren't gods at all." So you get the situation here. There's this major goddess, I think what we'd call a principality in Ephesus, Artemis. A big part of the trade of the town is selling kind of shrines and other doodads that are Artemis related. And Paul's persuading people that she's not the god that should be worshipped, so that's major business loss, and they're upset. This is happening not only here in Ephesus, but throughout the entire province. Of course, I'm not just talking about the loss of public respect for our business. I'm also concerned that the temple of the great goddess Artemis will lose its influence, and that Artemis, this magnificent goddess worshipped throughout the province of Asia and all around the world, will be robbed of her prestige. At this, their anger boiled, and they began shouting, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians!" A crowd began to gather, and soon the city was filled with confusion. Everyone rushed to the amphitheater, dragging along Gaius and Aristarchus, who were Paul's traveling companions from Macedonia. Inside, the people were all shouting, some one thing and some another. Everything was in confusion. In fact, most of them didn't even know why they were there. Alexander, who was thrust forward by some of the Jews, who encouraged him to explain the situation. He motioned for silence and tried to speak in defense. But when the crowd realized he was a Jew, they started shouting again and kept it up for 2 hours. "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians! Great is Artemis of the Ephesians!" For 2 hours. At last, the mayor was able to quiet them down enough to speak. "Citizens of Ephesus," he said, "everyone knows that Ephesus is the official guardian of the temple of the great Artemis, whose image fell down to us from heaven. Since this is an indisputable fact, you shouldn't be disturbed no matter what is said. Don't do anything rash." There's this riot going on as people feel that who they are, their unique goddess, Artemis, is being threatened by what Paul's doing. That's intolerable, and it starts this uproar, this kind of riot in them. There are, of course, a ton of interesting angles you could pursue with this story. I've actually spoken on it a few times with different angles that I'm talking about now. So arguably, some people wonder about the kind of spiritual warfare that was released when they burned these incantation books, if that would just, you know, upset the demonic hierarchy, and that's what's going on with this riot. But what this gets me thinking about tonight that I would love to talk about is the power of culture, which I think is a big theme throughout the entire Bible and in your life, the power of what a culture does, what culture is. "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." I basically take that as just saying, "Great is our God. Don't threaten our God, buddy, or we're going after you. Don't mess with our culture." And don't even suggest that our culture is not the greatest culture of all cultures ever, because we all know it is. That's what I take is going on here. I think you can make a pretty compelling case that this kind of "great is the Artemis of the Ephesians" thing is one of the biggest themes in the entire Bible. Comes up all the time. Comes up all the time as a major principality that will go after all people at all times, very much including godly people. It's something we have to watch out for, I think. So, for instance, in other parts of Acts, you'll see Paul or Stephen giving long speeches to a hostile crowd. They'll be doing fine throughout the entire speech until the very end, when they will inevitably say, "So now God is going to the Gentiles," meaning you people here who thought you had a monopoly on God, God's going elsewhere, and then they kill them, or they throw rocks at them, or they throw them in jail. It's that. It's all fine until you threaten the culture as being the godly culture. You could argue the central theme of Ephesians seems to be that God is all about breaking down dividing walls of hostility, breaking through our cultural walls and into somebody else's cultural backyard is a big theme, I think, in Ephesians. Hard to do. Doesn't happen very often on earth. Abraham, the father of faithful people, right? What did he do to become the father of faithful people? Well, his central task was to leave his family, his homeland, and his culture behind and go to a place where nobody knew who he was and where he didn't know what it was going to be like. And as a reward for doing that, he ultimately was going to be made the father of many nations, not just one. Even though for several millennia, no one got that. People saw Abraham as the father of one nation, the best nation, the special nation, the great nation, the nation you don't threaten or you're against God. Until the end, Jesus started saying, hang on, did you think Abraham was the father of just one nation? Isn't he the father of many nations, a multitude of nations? Wasn't that the whole point? In other words, wasn't Abraham himself about breaking out of the one special culture thing? You've got Psalms that point to this sort of breaking out of our own cultural prison as being where all of history is heading, like Psalm 67. That will be on your screen, which says, for the choir director, etc., may God be merciful and bless us. May his face shine with favor upon us. May your ways be known throughout the earth, your saving power among people everywhere. May the nations praise you, O God. Yes, may all the nations praise you. How glad the nations will be, singing for joy, because you govern them with justice and direct the actions of the whole world. May the nations, all of them, praise you, O God. Yes, may all the nations praise you. So when that happens, when all the nations praise you, not just one special nation who's got the truth, all nations praise you, then the earth will yield its harvest. We all get blessed when this culture thing has been busted out of. And God, our God, will richly bless us. Yes, God will bless us, and people all over the world will fear him. We get inspired with only very occasional, kind of inspirational, historical examples of this. Like, have you heard this story? Francis of Assisi. The Crusades are going on. You'll recall, it's the Christians against the invading Muslims. And this holy war breaks out. I don't know if it rings a bell, Christians against Muslims. I think there might be some resonance to it. And these Crusades break out. And people, the soldiers for Jesus' people, wear the cross on their shield as they go to battle. And there are stories being sung of valor on the parts of the good guys. And now, of course, as times have passed, we hear plenty of stories about atrocities on the part of the good guys, tons of those. But one man takes a different approach, Francis of Assisi. He decides, kind of under cover of darkness, as the story goes, to go and try to talk to the leading Muslim, I think it was Saladin, so big leader, Muslim leader, and to try to tell him about Jesus as a gift, not to fight him with arms, but to go to him with the love of the Lord. So he gets up to near where Saladin is, gets discovered, gets carried to Saladin, potentially to be killed, and, you know, at Saladin's word. And Saladin said, what do you want? And he said, I came here to basically tell you about Jesus. And Saladin said, okay. So Francis stayed with him for a week and shared with him about Jesus. Saladin loved him. Did not accept Jesus. Said to Francis at the end, though, what can I do for you? You have shown me love. How can I show you love in return? And Francis said, well, technically, I've been trying to do this monastery, and technically, the monastery I want to do is actually in Jerusalem, and a lot of the land in Jerusalem you own. Any chance you could give me some land to build a monastery? And Saladin built him the first Franciscan monastery. Breaking out of culture. We don't get too many examples of that sort of thing, about somebody so countercultural as that. There was this, I don't know if you've ever taken this course called the Perspectives in the World Christian Movement course, big popular course on missions. Ralph Winter, who started it from the U.S. Center on World Mission, has written an article, which is quirky. I don't know if it's true, but he basically says you can chart world history on these terms if you want. There's a part of the world where people know Jesus. They either start sharing Jesus outside their culture with their enemies, their cultural enemies outside them, and if they refuse to do it, God will ultimately let those enemies conquer the Christians so that the Christians will tell them it as slaves. And he says, you can see that pattern again and again and again. Which is it going to be? Of course, Ralph Winter has an axe to grind. He's a missions teacher after all. All to say, this strikes me as relevant as our conference theme suggests, our discovery process as Vineyards on the East Coast. Maybe you've noticed that our country seems fairly polarized into warring cultures. You've heard of the red states and the blue states, perhaps. As evangelicals, unless I'm missing it, we fit into the red state side of things. However, sadly, most of us are living in blue states. We aren't living with our people. We're living with them. Does God hate us? We're with them. All except I'm told by the Medes, Virginia, which is a red state. So for all of you, ignore everything I'm going to say henceforward. But the rest of us, I think we're living in blue states. And Virginia, you have incipient blueness in you, I want to point out. I think, it's sort of the Artemis with the Ephesians things, we're under some pressure as believers in Jesus in a life-giving way in a blue state culture. And the pressure I think we're under is, on the one hand, it comes from the culture itself, which can look upon people like us with skepticism. On the other hand, I think it comes from other believers in Jesus from other parts of the country or from within us who look to us to be loyalists. Are you loyalists to the evangelical culture? Oh, you blue state people. I think both are challenging tests for us because I think the loyalist part of us can give us a certain greatest Artemis of the Ephesians thing. We've got to prove to the culture around us that we'll stand over and against that culture because they're wrong. They're the enemies. We've got the truth, and we've got to stand on the truth. And the important thing, even words like stand, I'm going to stand on the truth. There's a certain defiance in that. I mean, as opposed to I'm going to, like, chat about the truth over tea. That's just not quite, I'm standing. I think we feel some pressure to stand in a way that I think could make us a certain Ephesian rioting sort of culture if we don't watch ourselves. Over the last couple years, I've had the fun chance to talk with a few of you about this stuff, and I've thrown out a few paradigms that have helped me in this conversation, and in the rest of our time together, I'd like to look at two different ways that I'd like to propose we can break out of culture. One way is by breaking out of culture into people who we might tend to regard as our cultural enemies. People who are against the very things that as believers we tend to be for. And then the second thing I'll talk about after that is how to break out of culture across races. I think both are fairly significant topics of conversation for us in the East and have a lot of overlap, not entirely the same, but a lot of overlap. Let me talk about this probably applies a bit more to the cultural enemies side of things rather than the racial side of things, though it might well apply there too. But I'd like to suggest two different paradigms that have helped me. Again, I've talked to a few of you about this, but let me throw them out for what it's worth. One I'm going to call centered versus bounded sets. One way you might want to think about these centered versus bounded set, you could draw, if you were in the mood to draw, on your white sheet, a circle, and draw next to it a dot. I got this first was suggested to me by Todd Hunter, one of our former national directors, and I'm told by Mike Trigiano that Todd just ripped it off from Wimber. So I'm in the lineage of Wimber with this one, I want to tell you. Let me tell you a brief story, and then let's talk about centered and bounded sets. I am friends with a terrific, vibrant new church in our area. They have just a ton to teach me and a ton to teach us. I'm going to speak kind of in a way that they're the bad guys in the story a little bit, only to pull back and tell you that they're just great. They love Jesus and are doing some great things. They were planted from a group in the South that we've tried to learn a lot from as a church. They've sent mission teams all over the world into very hostile cultures and thrived. They sent a team into Boston and didn't thrive. And so at one point, the leader of this larger movement from the South encouraged the local pastor to come and talk to me because we'd planted about the same time and had grown pretty quickly, and to find out what have we done differently. And I talked to this guy, and we talked for a while, and after a moment, or probably after an hour or 2 hours, I finally said, let me ask you one question. Do you like Boston? And he said, what do you mean like? And I said, like it. You know, I don't know, like you would live here if you weren't planning a church here. He said, oh God, no. I said, oh, well, there you have it. He says, my wife, at that time, she said she cries herself to sleep every night that we can't go back to the South. It's just like hell. And I said, if I could just suggest, I think that might explain some of the difference between my doing a little bit better, our church doing a little bit better than yours. I like it. I would live here. This is kind of my people. I would live here, period. And he basically said at the time, and he's actually had this conversation with me since, that he said, it was like 4 years later, he said, 4 years ago, you asked me if I liked Boston. I was so mad at you when you said that. I went home, I just chewed on it. But now I think there's actually a point you have to make, and we've had the conversation since, so again, great guy. But at the time, he said, how could you like it? I said, what do you mean? He says, Boston, everybody you talk to hates God, is completely secular, a larger percentage of atheists here than anywhere else, totally true. I've never talked to so many professing atheists as opposed to secularists ever. You can't, you know, everywhere you look is atheism. He says, atheists here, the social issues they're driving are the most anti-God social issues anywhere. And it's all, if you read the Boston Globe, that's the only point of view ever presented, is the completely blue state, anti, you know, whatever the godly points of view points are. He says, how could you possibly like it? I said, I don't know. My people, I just love them. I don't know why, I just do. And he said, well, I don't even get it. And I said, well, so if I were to ask you, I said, so it seems like what you're saying is that here's the people that you feel you could best reach. And I'm not saying this, I don't mean to be mean by this, so tell me if I'm wrong. I'm not trying, there's no spin on this. This is not judgmental. I'm just curious. In one sense, you could reach people who are not churchgoers, but who are friendly to churchgoers. In other words, who like church people. Probably who are going to be politically conservative, if I understand it. So in that sense, would support our president, President Bush, would be supportive of President Bush. Who would be anti-abortion, I'm assuming is a given, who is culturally anti-abortion, who would be anti-gay marriage, I'm assuming that would be a given. And that's the people you feel like you could best reach. It's people who would be predisposed towards that before meeting you. He said, that's probably true. I said, well, there's about 8 of those people in Boston that I know of. I think, I haven't done the research, but I think there's about 8. And so I think you could do a great job at going deep, but you're not going to go broad with that. I said, you've got to find a way. If that's really what your calling is, God bless you, but I don't think you're going to go very broad. And he just shook his head and said, how could that be anything else but our calling? That's the Christian calling. So I submit to you. Let me talk about this bounded, centered, set thing. Bounded set, but what I mean by bounded set is anything that you're either in it or you're out of it. So I am male. That is true. I am in the bounded set of all males. If you are a woman, tough luck, you're outside my set. I am a Bostonian. I'm in that set. I'm an American. I am above 6 feet tall. Ha, 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 I'm in that set. So sooner or later, I can get a bounded set that goes smaller and smaller and smaller until the only person who can fit in is me. But nonetheless, that's bounded set. You have some things that you're either in or you're out of. In bounded sets, let's say if you're a benevolent bounded set, you can offer people the chance to dive into your bounded set. So for instance, you could say, I am this guy in this church. I'm a pro-Bush. I'm a anti-abortion, I'm a anti-gay marriage, loving Jesus, evangelical, charismatic person. If you want to jump into my pool, it's a great pool. You can go to heaven, there's wonderful people there who will love you and nurture you, and there's a lot of life in that pool. Do you want to jump in? That's a bounded set. Let's talk about centered set. Centered set is just this dot. Let's say the dot for our purposes is Jesus. And let's say the only issue with the dot is if you are moving towards the dot or not. So for instance, if the dot is, you know, this podium, I might be, let's say, you know, 3 feet from the podium, and I'm moving basically towards the dot, Jesus. But let's say someone is like up yonder, way up yonder, up, way up into another state, but they're also pointing towards the dot. What this theory would say is that's almost as good. It's not as good because they're not as close as the great me here, this close to the dot. But on the other hand, there at least the issue is, where are you pointing? Let's say I, 3 feet away from the podium, my arrow kind of deviated a little bit, and I'm oscillating. I'm still very close, but I'm kind of going this way for a while. What this would argue is that those people are better off than me in that instance. Not that God's slow to anger. I could certainly turn back, you know, and then I'd be close again, and life's good. But in the moment, it would argue they're better off than me. I think, believe it or not, that has fairly profound implications for how we think about who we are in the world around us. Is that, are we people who are all about what makes us bounded? In other words, what makes us us? And we're into us. So we are people, even in the vineyard, we have so many great gifts in the vineyard. And in a strange way, we have things that are at war with each other. So on the one hand, we have a casual ethos in the vineyard. Which is great, one of the things I love in here. We have a powerful musical heritage right from Wimber, you know, who brought the Righteous Brothers stuff and started a whole wave that was just not seen, as I understand it, around the world. He kind of kicked off a whole wave of contemporary worship, and we've just continued it through Casey and others ever since. We have a profound musical heritage. We're evangelicals, we're charismatics, we're the radical middle between those two things. So there's a certain amount of things that are going to define any culture appropriately, and we have things that define our culture appropriately. On the other hand, there's a certain sense where I think what we're realizing as a vineyard, so I've been in conversation a fair amount with Bert recently, I'm actually head of a new task force, national one, which I'll tell you about, where what Bert is telling me is, Dave, centered set, man, we gotta leave this bounded set, we gotta figure out ways to get past the bounded set. In other words, we gotta find ways to say, dive into Vineyard. Oh, you'll love it. That pool of Vineyard's a great pool because we're the mellow, contemporary worship, evangelical but casual dress, really into missions. A little bit, if I may say, this is where I'm headed, white, let's face it, white movement. That's who we are. Dive in, and we're open to more. I think what Bert's saying to me is, that is the past. The future is centered set. We are about Jesus. We are guiding people towards him, and we're reaching beyond our cultural boundaries to people who might seem like cultural enemies in ways that possibly could be refreshing. Let me give you another paradigm for what it's worth. I got this from a great psychologist. Seemed like he was going through a Christian thing for a while. It's not quite clear if he stayed there. But he suggested this. It was a stage theory of spiritual development that he basically argued this. This was like a life changer for me. I don't know, maybe it'll be for you. He suggested that every human, if they were to have perfect emotional development, it would match perfect spiritual development. And we would see those things match up through four stages that he talked about. However, most of us don't have perfect emotional development. We get arrested in one of the stages, and so we stall out emotionally and spiritually, and that's helpful to understand how we interact with each other. So stage one, I'm going to paraphrase him, I'm going to call criminal. That would be the equivalent to being a toddler. I have toddlers now. I got a lot of young kids. I've seen lots of toddlers. I have one now. Is our three-year-old a criminal right now? Grace, do you want to... It's been a rough week with her, so I think we're really into this right now, that toddler stage is criminal stage. Toddlers don't care how you're doing, if I might say. You know, it's the rare toddler who's on a rampage of, I want this, give me this, I'm trying now, who suddenly stop and say, but Dad, how are you? You know, because enough about me, how are you? It just doesn't happen. Toddlers, appropriately, are at a stage in life where they want what they want and they're going to get what they get. Now, if we get arrested in the toddler stage, we are in kind of a criminal, chaotic world where the whole world is something we just got to figure out how to get ours. And this psychologist argues that there are two institutions that support stage one criminal behavior best. Jail, for obvious reasons, because it gives boundaries to that arrested behavior. Or, he argues, the boardroom. He says, you can do very well as a CEO if you're a high-functioning stage one. Because if you're really all about getting for your company and yourself, you could actually thrive for quite a while. So those two institutions. Stage two would be about ages 6 and 7, and he would call those kids and people who get arrested in that stage rules-based. Rules-based. Because when we're stage two, suddenly what we want to know is, what do mommy and daddy want us to do? One of our children got into the stage two section way before his younger brother. And so, I mean, we'd be at these Vineyard events. We used to have kind of wild Holy Spirit meetings in our church and some evening meetings. And so we'd be at those wild Holy Spirit meetings with our kids. And so our stage two kid would just be watching us to see what he's supposed to be doing. And so if everyone's hands were up, he'd be kind of looking around going. And then if we're on our faces, you know, he'd be on his face. And he'd be like looking around like, is that okay? Is that okay? Meanwhile, his little brother was running up and grabbing the drumsticks and banging during the meeting. Or would be running around. And so he'd be looking around and we'd hear his voice going, psst, you, get over here, get you. And he was making commotion more than the other kid. And so we'd say to him, look, we're the parents. We'll handle it. And he would give us a dirty look like, not very well, evidently. You know, rules-based. It is spiritual and emotional development from criminal. You do need to know what are the rules, what's right and wrong. The psychologist argues there are two institutions that primarily support stage two, rules-based. The military is one. Heavy rules, we understand what's right, what's wrong, what's good, what are the boundaries, which is why the military is often a great transition for people who have been in stage one to stage two, because it's so, appropriately, it's the structure, it's given the structure. And he argues the second institution that best supports stage two are churches. Because churches tell you what's right, what's wrong, what's good, what's bad, what's moral, what's immoral. What are the rules? He argues, don't be offended by this, that 98% of churches are stage two churches. 98%. It's almost so pervasive, it's hard to imagine what else churches could do under his way of thinking. And he says, that's not bad. That's great. God bless it. Because all the things you would learn in any given church of that nature, is good. It's usually true. Nothing wrong with that. But it's stage two true. It's just, what are the rules? What's right? What's wrong? What's good? What's bad? Stage three, he would link into the teen years, which he would call rebellious. He argues that's development, that's spiritual progress. You should rebel as a teen. And the way teens rebel, under his theory, is they start saying, who died and made all those stage two rules the rules? What's behind those rules? What? I mean, tell me more. Why is that true? Why shouldn't I smoke? You know, why shouldn't I have sex before marriage? Why? If the parents are stage two, it's very threatening, because they'll be saying, why? I'll tell you why. You know, whack. That's why. What kind of rebel are you? Kind of sex before marriage? Don't. You know, that's the stage two thing. What he argues, though, is that's actually healthy. We have to do that. Now, he says what stage three doesn't realize is that there is a stage four. Stage three can get confirmed in stage three. So stage three, the institutions that best support stage three, actually there's one, he says, is colleges, universities. Because universities get people at that age, right? You're getting 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds. That's stage three. That's the stage three. And so universities have to be stage three, he feels. So the whole argument you'll see in the press is that we aren't getting conservative voices on campus. Of course you're not. It's a stage three institution. By definition, of course you're only going to hear liberalism and rebellion. So just a little throw in here. This always gets me in trouble, but I keep saying it, which just shows I'm one of those people. I walk down that road. I fall in a hole. I walk down the same road the next day. I don't go around the hole. I fall into the same hole again. Why do I do this? So here's that. Here's the hole I'm falling into now. Political parties, for what it's worth. On this theory, it's a trick question in the end, which political party, like the Republican Party, where would they fit in this grid best? Stage two, right? Rules. What's right, what's wrong, what's good, what's bad? Morality. The Democrats, here's the trick, I think it's a split between stage three and stage one. I think it actually is. I think it's both. I don't think there's almost any stage two in the Democratic Party, though. And that is part of why we have a spitting match with each other between the parties, is we just don't get each other. And so there's a different way, too. I've discovered that stage two and stage three shower contempt upon each other. They do shower contempt on each other, but it's a different sort of contempt. Perhaps you've noticed this. So stage two contempt towards stage three is, you libertines, you rules breakers. Even the use of the word liberal as like a swear word, liberals. Does that sound a little stage two to you? I mean, it's like that. I need to say no more than just to say you're a liberal. I mean, I'm sure you get why that's a shameful thing to be, liberal. That you get, you're just stuck. I mean, it's a uniquely stage two to stage three way of doing it. It's just say you're a rules breaker. You don't believe in anything. You're godless. The stage three to stage two contempt is the contempt they would show towards their parents who don't understand them anymore. And so it's sneering. It's a sneering sort of contempt. So in Cambridge, Cambridge is dominated by colleges, it is stage three central. We are in a stage three culture. France is usually regarded as a stage three culture, for what it's worth. And in Cambridge, you know, let's say if you see a bumper sticker about our president, do you think it's supportive or not? It's not. But it's not just not supportive, it's like rude, you know. I'm trying to even remember them now. They're all blanking, but it's usually just sneering about what an idiot he is, what a fool he is. It's sneering. That is stage three towards stage two contempt. That's how they play with each other. And finally, though, what stage three doesn't realize is that there is a stage four, which this psychologist calls mystical. And what he says is, once you get past rebellion, if you continue on a healthy emotional trajectory and don't get arrested in rebellion, what you discover is that all those things that your parents taught you in stage two, if they were stage two, or you believed in stage two, even if they weren't stage two, are true. Almost all those things are true. But they're true in a different and richer way than you had imagined. So, for instance, a classic scripture on that note would be, believe on the name of the Lord Jesus Christ and so be saved. Stage two, I think under this theory, would say, okay, I believed on the name of the Lord Jesus Christ January 16th, 1977, and so I am saved. I'm going to heaven. Stage four, I think, would say, wow, believe on the name of the Lord Jesus Christ and so be saved. That's like freaking me out. Believe, meaning like now? What does it mean to believe now? Believe tomorrow. Believe. How do I believe? Oh, I'm in. I do believe. I want to believe. Show me how to believe now. and so be saved. Meaning like now, like my life's going to be transformed. Like in Galatians, Paul says, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision matters, only a transformed life. So is that saved, the transformed life, that I'm saved? How do I know if my life is being transformed? I want it. Oh God, I want to believe on you and I want to be saved. Kind of a different way of looking at it. You might have noticed that stage four under this theory is much more uncertain than stage two. Because stage two is about rules under this theory, it's very certain. It knows the rules. One picture actually that someone at this conference gave me, and then I'll move on shortly to the multi-ethnic side of things, but that might help you in this, is a picture of three different stick figures. He had done some PhD work, and he said, you know, as you talk to stage theory, I think about, like, picture a stick, you could even draw this if you wanted, and we're so artistically inclined. I think of a stick figure, a stick figure, and then a circle above their head. This would be what you might call primitive humankind. And he would say, under that theory, primitive humankind believed there was truth out there, but there was no access between us and it. You had to have, you know, witch doctors to help us understand what's going on in that truth. So then draw a stick figure and a circle about the same size as the stick figure, or maybe even in the palm of their hand. He said you could call that modern humankind. Once we hit the Enlightenment, we began to think, there's truth, and it's about the size of my hand. I can look at it, I can dissect it, I've seen it, I've circled it, I get it. I can look at it from all angles, got it, figured it out. So now draw a big circle and a little tiny stick figure just barely inside of it. And he said, that's what you might call stage four humankind, which is realizing everywhere you look is truth. It's all truth. And I'm inside of it. And the rest of my life is going to be spent walking through it. So it's a much more uncertain stage than stage two. Here's why I bring this up. People often ask us, as did my friend from the South, how have you grown so much in Cambridge, Massachusetts? For what it's worth, only said by point of reference, the average church size in Cambridge, I did the math again recently to see if I was wrong, I think I'm right, is about 30 people. The next biggest church to us is an African-American church, venerable, been around for a long time, vibrant church in some ways. It's a little under 500, and we're at 1,000, so we're double as big as the next biggest church in our town, and we've been there since 98. And so people ask us all the time. We've had news stories done on us. The Boston Globe's been there like four times recently. You know, we get a lot of comment. And it's, who are you guys and how do you do it? I think it's because we're the only game in town like us. The options in Cambridge are either conservative churches that stand against the liberal onslaught of the culture, ethnic churches, meaning mono-ethnic churches of an immigrant culture, or liberal churches, Unitarians, UCC, people who would say, you know, in Unitarian culture, as you understand, even using the word God is controversial as being too offensive and conservative. So there's that. And then there's this anomaly, which is us. And the us is, it's hard to pin us down. No one knows where we stand politically. Hopefully it's because I don't believe in politics, and that's I believe in them in some sense, but not in staking my turf politically. I don't believe in it. I think we try to be pretty centered set. I think that's why my friend who came in from Harvard Div School kept moving closer, as he kept thinking, these guys, I'm waiting for them to talk like the other evangelical churches around here who are over and against me, over and against everything I believe. And I never heard you say it, I just heard you talk about the living God. And I kind of moved closer and closer. I did Living Waters, my life got transformed, I did all this stuff. And then I realized it's all true, Jesus is true, there's a living God. There's healings, this is the greatest thing ever. I think that's why we can be in about as liberal a place as you're going to find on the East Coast. I mean, there's other, you could defend your place as being more liberal, possibly, but I'd fight back. We're close to being as liberal as you could possibly get, and growing quite a bit. We're actually planning a second site of our church this next year in downtown Boston, actually a second site. I think that's why. And when people come to talk about us and ask about us, I actually think it's all about this stuff, stage theory stuff, that we're trying to be a stage four church. Because, right, if Cambridge is a stage three culture, what effect do you think it will have to be a stage two church? Can you understand why it's impossible? You can never reach stage three with stage two because it actually, on these terms, is spiritual regression. And so in one sense, all the sneering liberals are right when they say, I'm more spiritually advanced than you, stage two person. And they may be going to hell. That's one of the weird things about this theory. You could leave stage two where you're actually going to heaven, spiritually progressed at stage three, where you're actually going to hell. But that's, on a weird way, part of the risk, right? When you have college students, as many of you have, who go away to liberal universities and lose faith for a while and then regain it, I wonder if some of that's going on. They had to lose it to actually grow and own something as their own in a more of a stage 4E sort of way. So it will never work, from my point of view, in a stage 3 culture to be a stage 2 church. It can't work. You're always going to be marginalized, and you'll always see that it's because the devil's at work in your city, right? The reason you're small, the reason you're embattled, is because it's controlled by the devil. Look at all these people. Read the newspapers. Talk to any neighbor. It's controlled by the devil. As opposed to thinking, I wonder if I could reach those people. But the only way to do that is to completely change who we are. We have to kind of reformulate, and it's like some sort of Star Trek picture where we disintegrate and then reintegrate later on in a different way. I think we have to do that. So that's why I bring it up, for what it's worth. I have one more story, but I won't tell it because this is going to go long. So a few brief thoughts on this, and then I'd like to talk about kind of crossing racial boundaries a bit. A few thoughts on how hypothetically you could break down some dividing walls where we live, that we could get out of the greatest Artemis of the Ephesian stage 2 culture we can go to, that we are loyal to evangelicalism, and just think, I'm only loyal to Jesus, and I am loyal to him. But I'm loyal to him in a way I want to reach people. How might we do that? One way is you could befriend as many cultural enemies as you can and learn from them. I can't imagine. I mean, we've had so many atheists over for dinner, and I've learned from so many of them. I briefly thought of a story where we were living in San Francisco, and actually I think the leading lesbian neighborhood in the country, and right next to the Castro, leading gay neighborhood, Grace and I lived there when we got married. We met our neighbor, quiet young guy. He seemed kind of ill, and he would talk to me a little bit, but kind of would duck his eyes. I think I represented kind of big, he was obviously gay, and I represented kind of big straight guy, and he didn't like me. He liked Grace a bit more. She's friendlier than me anyway, as you'll discover if you meet us both. We would hear him through our walls, which were really thin, like coughing like crazy, heavy cough. And we saw his little boxes on his doorstep most days. And so finally Grace said, he's dying of AIDS, and he's got Meals on Wheels coming to him. And so we tried to figure out, should we bring that up? Should we try to pray for this guy? And so Grace finally slid a note under his door and said, this guy's name was Marty, and said, Marty, I've heard you coughing. You know, we can hear you through the walls. I'm so sorry. It's obvious you're sick. To be honest, I've wondered if you have AIDS and if it's quite late stage. And I actually believe in Jesus. Grace is now telling me the story's wrong, but pretend it's right because we don't have time for this. So she said, I care. Do you want to talk? And she talked. He said yes. He said, I think it was a note back initially saying, yes, I'd like to talk. So they spend the time, they talk. And she ends up in quite a few conversations with him. And she ends up praying for healing for him. Here's the whole story about how his family doesn't know. She's one of the few people who knows, apart from the friends bringing the Meals on Wheels, who knows. She now knows, and she's praying for him. She's the believer. And so did Marty come to the Lord? Probably not, but nonetheless, but there was a meaningful, centered set sort of thing going on, which I think is sort of indicative of befriending cultural enemies and learning from them. What's his experience? What's he going through? What's going on with him? Second, given what I've just thrown out, it might be obvious to say we could stay out of culture wars. We could stay out of culture wars. You can see why, on both centered set thinking and on the stage theory thing, culture wars cannot be won on these terms. They can't be. Thirdly, we can become judgment-free. Bert talked about that so powerfully. I had all sorts of things to say, but I'm going to drop it because I'm going to get this race thing. But if we are filled with judgment, Jesus condemns it, and we can never do this. We have to be judgment-free to be able to reach people in this way. And finally, or not finally, but I think there'd be some real upside to getting hip to multi-ethnicity. I think on the East Coast, we are not going to be relevant unless we understand multi-ethnicity. I think it's a given. I think among the people I talk to, if you're not multi-ethnic, you're either privileged, fearful suburbanites, or you're racist. That's it. And yet, we are one of the few multi-ethnic churches in Cambridge and Boston, I think, especially of any size. I'm going to show you something. This is the long 17-minute thing, and I'll have a few wrap-up comments. Here's an edited version of an interesting little lecture given by, you may have heard or may not have heard about a book called Divided by Faith, but another book called United by Faith. They sort of swept the evangelical world by talking about race issues as candidly as they did, from these academics. They're researchers, who one's at Rice and one's somewhere else, who talk about multi-ethnicity. There was a panel recently that one of our staff members went to, where all four of the authors of the second book, United by Faith, were on the panel. And I'm giving you excerpted comments that might suggest something to you from two of them. Michael Emerson, white guy, who is the lead author on both United and Divided by Faith, and a guy named George Yancey, African-American who was one of his team members who wrote a great book called One Body, One Spirit. Here's them.
The slide with the photograph of the kids. I don't know how well you can see the slide, but I try to put an arrow pointing to my son. He's kind of in the center, kind of the pale-faced kid. So I don't know if you can see that, but this is his youth group at church. And this is the world that he grows up in. And a question that comes up a lot is, what happens to the racial and ethnic identities of kids like this that are in these kind of congregations or living in mixed neighborhoods? Do they stop being African American, Honduran, Mexican, Korean, white? Do they become different? So we've been trying to, one of the things we've been doing and studying is trying to figure out what actually happens. And we've been looking both at children and at adults. And I just want to give you one specific example, but the conclusion we had is one we did not expect, and that is that people that are in these kind of congregations, multiracial congregations, have a stronger sense of ethnic identity, their own, than those who are not, those who are in uniracial congregations. So let me give you an example how, why it works that way. There's a postdoctoral fellow working at Rice right now with me, and she's been spending the past couple of years comparing Korean congregations, those that are all Korean, to Koreans that are in multi-ethnic, multiracial congregations. And this is what she found. In the Korean congregation she studied, she found that they're actually great tools for Americanizing the Koreans. And specifically this, they are much more likely to stress that success comes through individual hard work, just like the kind of the dominant theme in America. They did not talk much at all about what it means to be Korean, in part because everybody's Korean, so that just sort of goes right over. They came to view other minority groups with distrust. Particularly, they hear that they should distrust and avoid African Americans and Latinos, and they come to practice this. So not only do they fear it, but what she studied their volunteering. What is it that the church and the people in the churches actually do, and found that they are much less likely to be volunteering in situations that either they're working with or serving African Americans and Latinos. They will work some with whites, but mostly what they do is they volunteer and serve Koreans. So it's a very focused, inward focus. Now, when she went to Koreans and interviewed them and spent time with them in multi-ethnic, multiracial congregations, what she found is one, which surprised her, the Koreans there were much more articulate about what it meant to be Korean, what it meant to be Korean-American, and were much more confident in that identity. They also were also able to describe differences between being Korean and being Christian in a way that in the Korean congregations they could not. It was hard for them to separate the two. They expressed more positive attitudes and had more knowledge about other racial and ethnic groups in the United States. And in that volunteering patterns, what they actually did, they were much more likely to be involved working with and serving groups other than Koreans. So, and one more thing that she found, they had a lot more knowledge about other groups, not just about their own, but other groups. Why is this? Well, one is just the pure demographic context of having contact with people. Another big thing is that the theologies, what is stressed in these congregations. When multiracial congregations are there, pastors and leaders are usually stressing that, you know, something's happening here. Look at us, we're this motley crew, yet God has brought us together, and we're brought together by one thing, Christ. And so there's a lot of discussion about this. We had a person in the congregation I was worshiping in who for his entire life hid the fact that he was 100% Latino, he's Mexican, but he had just enough, I don't know, somehow he's able to pass. In fact, he married a white woman partly for that. Came to the congregation, worshiped there for about 5 months, and came into the pastor crying and saying, for the first time in my life, I can admit that I am Hispanic, and that means something. And people, I don't have to feel funny about that. People actually celebrate the fact that I am that, and I'm going to come out, as they say. And so he has. And he's a kid favorite in that group I showed you. All right, what I want to do here for just a few minutes is, been studying these things for years, is to summarize them all into two categories. What are their promises and what are their limits? And I'm going to go fairly fast, but if you go to the next slide, a key promise that we saw is social ties seem to be dramatically different. If you go to the next slide. When we were designing our survey here, my colleagues and I, we came up with what we call the ring of social ties. So you start in the center with a spouse if you're married, then to your two best friends, and work your way out, friends in a congregation, and out. So all of these levels, and we measured all of these levels of friendships. And one of the things we asked them was the racial diversity of their two best friends, of their friends in the congregation, so on. So if we, I'm not going to go through all of them, but the one I'll show you, we found the same effect in all these cases. So the next slide. So what we're here is taking the social network, their overall social network, and we described to them what that meant. People they like to hang out with, people they spend time with on the phone, etc., in all sorts of organizations in their neighborhood and so on. We asked them this. What I'm showing here is the percent who said that most or all of the people in their social network were their same race. And divided into people that go to same race congregations, homogenous congregations, those who are not in a congregation, and then those who are interracial, multiracial congregations. And you can see this dramatic difference. 72% of all people that go to same-race congregations say that their entire social network is mostly or all the same race. If they're not in a congregation, it drops a little bit. And I wrote in a book, Divided by Faith, saying that what religion does in the United States is intensify whatever racial division we already have. So 62% of those who are not in congregations, say most or all, are the same race as them. But look at that drop. People are interracial congregations, only a quarter said most or all. I break it down here by each group, and you see the exact same effect, always this big drop if they are in multiracial congregations. Well, if we go to the next slide, we'll see another promise of multiracial congregations, and that is an organizational home for multiracial people or multiracial families. Certainly, we know by following the census that those categories of families and people who are of multiple races is growing. And if you're them, you would know that it's always a struggle. If churches are going to be one race only and you're mixed, where do you go? A lot of people in these congregations come there because they feel at home there. They constantly talk about felt welcome, felt at home. As this woman said, no one stared at us. We felt very welcome. They're a mixed race couple here. We saw other interracial couples. We felt at home. We didn't have to explain anything, or like when you go to this grocery store and they ask if we're together. That happens so much, so we felt very welcomed here. Last promise that I want to discuss is status. Status effects. I'm talking here economics. I'm talking here your social status, and I'm talking spiritual status. One in particular example. I've got a book coming out in April, and my co-author or with author is a man named Dr. Rodney Wu, who is a pastor of a multiracial congregation in Houston. And so in an interview here, this is what he had to say about this issue. Many in our congregation, he said, develop relationships with believers from other cultures that eventually help them search for jobs, negotiate the immigration system. I should point out this is a congregation with people from 43 different nations, get medical treatment, pursue education. For example, David Adcock, one of our members, has used his connections as a professor to help members continue with their schooling. In fact, he's used more than once to help people that were going to be sent to Africa because they didn't have the appropriate papers or something, get into school. So not only are they getting education, but they're able to stay in the U.S., Lisa Adcock, his wife and a medical doctor, has more than once helped members get medical treatment they otherwise would not know how to obtain or could not afford. Fernando Medina, has spent a great deal of time helping people get immigration papers, helping Spanish-speaking immigrants navigate the English-speaking system. He has taught English classes, accompanied people to government offices to translate, hosted free health clinics at the church in Spanish for people that could not afford basic medical treatment. And I love this one, he has taught our English speakers how to speak Spanish. All right, George Yancey.
When, right before this project begun, my wife and I, Sherilyn, we moved to Fort Worth, and we wanted to find a church. And so we started visiting around some different churches. I'm a little bit taller than you, Mike. I have to move this up a little bit. We visited some different churches, found one that we enjoyed, but it was a predominantly white church. And I was at a point where I wanted to be in more of a racially diverse atmosphere. And so we tried to go for a while. She even joined a women's Bible study group. But in time, I just did not feel comfortable, and I knew the church was not going to become multiracial. And so I said, this isn't going to be our church. And she went to the women's Bible study and told them that this was going to be the last time she was going to be there. And when they asked why, she said, well, we're trying to find a church where we can find more racial diversity. And their response was very typical. Their response was, well, we welcome everybody. Our doors are open. And before we say, oh, yeah, they don't know what they're thinking about, this church was obviously it was not a church that was hostile to people of color. I mean, then first Sunday I would have been gone. This was not a church that was in any way a white supremacist church or anything like that. They were very friendly to both me and my wife. They were a welcoming church in many ways. But I knew that church was not going to become multiracial. And I knew just opening our doors and living the Christian life was going to change that. Part of my interest, beyond some of the other aspects that have come out, is if we are convinced that multiracial congregations is where we should be heading towards, then how do we get there? First principle is inclusive worship. That can mean a lot of different things. It can mean a lot of different things. It can mean mixing up the worship, having different types of songs in the same service, or having one service is one way, the next Sunday do something completely different. But it's very important. If you blindfolded me and put me in a church in the United States, 90% of the time, I can tell you the rest you'll make with the church by listening to the worship. And I'm not a genius, as my wife Sherilyn reminds me again and again and again. Why is that? Because I know the racial cultural worship style. Now, if you put me in multiracial churches, I'll start getting it wrong. Why is that? You have to have a worship style that when people come in, they feel like they can be a part of it. Sometimes the only time you're going to be able to speak to that visitor is that one Sunday that they visit. And if your worship style communicates to them, this is not for you, they may never come back. So you got to think about inclusive worship. Second principle is diverse leadership. People want to see themselves represented up there. They want to look up on the stage and at some point see themselves represented. They want to know that there's people from their own culture who have the pastor's ear. Amen. They want to know that they, if they matured and could grow spiritually, they could be in leadership. Diverse leadership is critically important because the pastor is going to be able to, has to adjust as well. I remember one interview we did with a pastor, and the pastor basically, and he was in Los Angeles, and the pastor basically said that he learned that the LA riots were not the LA riots to African Americans. He was a white pastor. They were called the LA uprisings. Because riots just mean people just go around and just burn things. Uprisings is a social movement. And it was a very important moment for him because up until that point, he only saw the police as protectors. Now, that didn't change his perspective, but it allowed him to minister to people with a different perspective. And that's very important, to be able to minister to people from a different perspective. And how can you do that unless you can hear from your leadership, which happens to be diverse? Intentionality, which seems like it's the opposite of an overarching goal, but it's really not. You must be intentional in thinking about what it takes to become multiracial. Once you do have this goal, you know that being multiracial is going to help you to meet that goal. Now you got to intentionally think about, what are we going to do now in order to become more racially diverse? That's why that church that we visited in Fort Worth was not going to become multiracial. Their doors were open, the people were friendly, but there's no intentionality behind it. And so they were not going to become multiracial. So you have to intentionalize it, because if you want to go against the current, and our current in our society is not towards multiracial voluntary organizations. If you want to go against the current, you're going to have to struggle some. You know, if you're dead, then the current just takes you away. If you want to go against the current, you better struggle some, and you better be intentional in doing it. But one of the things I've learned from watching MTV is, unlike when I grew up, and I'm not that old, but unlike when I grew up, my students are growing up in environments where friendships and romantic relationships across race are becoming normative. So if they go into churches where they see only their race, they are actually becoming uncomfortable with that. Now, that's our problem, but it also is an opportunity. The network multiracial churches mean that as we develop friends across race, we bring them into our churches. This is the church we found that tends to attract multiracial couples, college students. These are the churches I think hold a lot of promise for how we can think about the development of multiracial ministry, just reaching who we already have. For years, we as Christians would go to work with people of different races. We would go to school with people of different races, but then we wouldn't think about inviting to our church because you know, I go to a black church. You know, this person's white. I don't invite him or her to my church. We may have to change that thinking if we're going to really reach out to the next generation.
Let me make a few comments on those presentations you saw and how they might or might not apply to the Vineyard, and even why I'm relating that to kind of the secular liberal thing I started with. On the one hand, okay, I'm feeling bad about myself because I crammed too much into this talk. You know, we could do quite a while on multiracial church stuff, and we could do quite a while on secular liberal stuff. But I've run the risk of cramming too much in, because I think where they overlap in the Venn diagram sense is that they're about pushing beyond the great as Artemis of the Ephesians culture thing, where we are the right culture, we're going to be us. These are both saying, actually, what does it mean to get outside of that and start loving the people around us? And I think they're both the two central ways on the East Coast we have to do it. It's hard to think seriously about multiracial stuff. Again, if I can speak frankly, the Vineyard is a very white movement. It was interesting. I've talked now to a bunch of Vineyard leaders. I actually got named the head of a national task force on multi-ethnicity to see if we could grow in that. One of the speakers at the last national conference who's spoken internationally went out with the local hosting pastor and just chatting, and he said, just not negatively, but he said, wow, that is the single whitest crowd I've ever spoken to at our last national conference, for what it's worth. We certainly thought about this in Cambridge. We have a little easier than some of you, and that's a diverse community, although I'm not sure it's entirely going to work for the long run. The general comment that my community is not diverse, and so we're not diverse as a church, I think is becoming less and less popular out there, at least. That it seems like even in that setting, there are ways to think about it more profoundly if we want to. You know, in Cambridge, things they talked about, this intentional multi-ethnic worship, that's a killer, but we sure thought about it. So in our best, when we do our best, our worship would be about maybe half kind of Vineyard or Vineyard-influenced music, the Matt Redmonds of the world, about a quarter black gospel, and about a quarter hymns, to be able to try to reach a little bit more broadly when we're doing the best that we can do. That's actually what drew my African-American friend in, who's now a Vineyard church planner. among others, is that that was true. Hard to do, though. Not the easiest thing to pull off, but we've given it a shot. The idea of representing races on the platform. We think about that so much, we often fail. If I can give you our demographics, I think I've now surveyed the national movement on ethnic breakdowns or racial breakdowns in churches. I don't know if we're the most racially diverse large church in the movement, but we're close. We would, if we're not, the North Phoenix Vineyard might be giving us a run for the money. Those North Phoenixites, we're going to beat them. We're going to take them down. Just take me off, because I thought we were the most multiracial church in the movement until Brian Anderson, he's so humble. He got together with me to talk about this. He says, what have you done? We never think about this. This is so exciting. Multiracialness. Tell me more. He was like, Mr. Lerner. And then I get his survey back, and arguably they're more multiracial than we are. Just tick me off. But in my heart of hearts, I'm believing we're still number one. The numbers were funny. We're not that multiracial. On the one hand, we have about 60% basically white, about 17% in the broad sense of the word Asian, about 13% in the broad sense of the word black, and about 10% of all the other races that we have. So that's not much. On the other hand, in America, the stats are that you're regarded as a multiracial church, according to these guys, if you have only 80% of the dominant ethnicity in your church. 80%. That would put you in the top 5% of American churches, from what they're saying, if that were true. It's as hard as that is to believe. Kind of a low bar standard, one would think. I have this crazy thought, as the head, after all, of this new multi-ethnic task force. I had been on John Elmer's awesome church planting task force for many, many years, and I was just being so jealous of John up here cheerleading about churches planted in the 2 years since the last regional conference. And I thought, heck, I am the head of a task force now. I have power. So in theory, I could go around to regional conferences or people on my task force, which is hypothetical at this point, but it will exist. And in theory, we could cheer on people who crossed that 80% threshold in the last 2 years, right? Why couldn't we do that? And we could set that as a bar that's not apart from church planting. I'm all for church planting. We've planted two churches, and we're pretty young, and we got more hopefully on the way. I'm for it. But what we're wondering, I think, as a movement, I think I can say we accurately, because I think the board is with me on this, is if this multi-ethnicity thing will become almost as important, believe it or not, as church planting. Because we're running the risk in the Vineyard of being a sect, a kind of quirky sect with our quirky, fun, white culture. And I think our dreams as a movement are so much bigger than that. We want to reach the society. And in the urban centers, how uniquely white do you think the Boston to Washington, D.C. corridor is? Is it 95% white? I think that's probably a little high. So if we're looking just to reach people, I think what we're realizing as a movement is we really do want to take this seriously. So I would submit that to you. We actually ran a kind of a conference at our church recently for staff level people about multi-ethnicity. We'll take that show on the road if you want to hear more about it. We'll talk a bit more about it after the session tonight, as I'll tell you, but I submit that to you. You know, there's other things to think about for being a people who can break dividing walls, as the Vineyard on the East Coast. Believe big is one thing we could think about. It takes a lot of faith. The way I thought about phrasing this is pretend you have more faith than you do, which I thought the Vineyard is perfect for, because we believe in healing the sick. And we heal the sick a lot in our church. We have a testimony almost every week about we had deafness recently healed. And so, but to actually pray for the sick, don't you have to pretend you have more faith than you actually do at that moment? You know, that deaf person comes up and you're praying for them. You're like, oh, deafness? No sweat. I pray for deaf people. Only deafness? You're not lame too? Because if it's just deafness, you shouldn't be coming to me, because I've got assistants who can handle deafness. You know, praying for the sick is all about pretending we have more faith than we actually have. And then God meets us halfway so frequently. Well, I think if we're going to break down dividing walls with secular culture and break down dividing walls among races, we're going to have to believe big. We're going to pretend we have more faith than we actually have. You know, we're trying to believe for that in Cambridge. I got invited recently into a conversation to mediate a dispute between Muslims and Jews in Boston. The leading group of Muslims just built the second biggest mosque in the U.S., but ran out of money because Jewish groups started lobbying against them in the press that they were terrorists and connected to terrorists and anti-Semitic, which is defensible and possibly true. And so I got a call from this person who knew churches in the area and said, would you mediate this between them and solve this? They're both suing each other. There's all these lawsuits going on now. And I said, and you thought of me, why? Because I heard recently, for instance, that the other people who've tried to mediate it has been one of the people who mediated the Northern Ireland dispute. That was one. And they brought on the author of Harold Kushner, who wrote Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. He's a rabbi. They brought him in to mediate. And now they're looking to me to go where the Northern Ireland guy couldn't go. And I said to this person, and you thought of me, why? And the person said, because you're the church that believes in miracles. How can one say no to that? And I've got to say, I don't believe in this miracle just yet, so you can pray for me a little more. Believe big. As I think about this breaking down, dividing wall stuff here on the East Coast, maybe I'd like to leave you with a movie clip, short one this time, not 17 minutes. What does it mean? Why should we break down dividing walls? This is from this movie called Adaptation. You may have seen it. It's this wacky movie. At the end, it kind of goes crazy. It just goes bonkers at the end. I actually don't like the ending as much where this is from as the rest of the movie. But there are these two brothers, both played by Nicolas Cage. One's sort of a doofus and one's a worrywart. And they're both being hunted down by Meryl Streep, who I often think of as a serial killer. And they're in a bayou hoping to live. And they tell this story.
You're gonna find us.
I don't think so.
I don't want to die, Donald. I've wasted my life. I've wasted.
You did not. And you're not gonna die.
I wasted it. I admire you, Donald, you know? I spent my whole life paralyzed, worrying about what people think of me. And you, you're just oblivious.
I'm not oblivious.
No, you don't understand. I mean that as a compliment. It was this time in high school. I was watching you at the library window. You were talking to Sarah Marsh. I was so in love with her. I know. And you were flirting with her. And she was being really sweet to you.
I remember that.
And then when you walked away, she started making fun of you with Kim Kennedy. And it was like they were laughing at me. You didn't know it all? You seem so happy.
I knew. I heard them.
Well, how come you were so happy?
I love Sarah, Charles. It was mine. That love. I owned it. Even Sarah didn't have the right to take it away. I can love whoever I want.
She thought you were pathetic.
That was her business, not mine. You are what you love, not what loves you. That's what I decided a long time ago.
You don't even know why I brought it up. Maybe you do. We're on the East Coast, and we're people who love Jesus. But there are these cultures out there that are other. And some of them openly don't love us. Some of them mock us. And some of them don't mock us. They're just other. We just don't know them. But what if it's true that you are who you love, not who loves you? I just thought that seemed so profound. You know, you see that and you think, that's some secularist who's writing that, but there just seems profundity there. You are who you love, not who loves you. Wouldn't it be great if we grow and grow and grow and grow and grow? And not that it's easy, and I hope you don't hear any, you know, the risk of beating this multi-ethnicity drum at the vanguard of it is it seems judgmental. I don't feel judgmental. It's hard. So it's not, I have no judgment at all of the difficulty of it. More of the opportunity of it. That because we are who we love, couldn't we think about